Less than 30 people own as much wealth as the poorest 50% of humanity combined. That's 3.8 billion people in the bottom half and 30-ish at the top. Not 30 million or 30,000, 30. Think about that for a second. You could fit them all on a single private flight, and they've got as much economic power as half of the entire planet. And to make it even more fun, the concentration of wealth is actually accelerating. In 2016, it took 62 billionaires to match the wealth of humanity's poorest half. By 2017, that number shrunk to 43. And by 2018, we arrived at the current figure, 26 billionaires. And according to the 2022 World Inequality Report, 2020 saw the single steepest increase in billionaire share of global wealth ever recorded in history. Then in March of 2025, Oxfam released another chilling report confirming the trend. In the past 2 years alone, the richest 1% gained nearly twice as much wealth as the bottom 99% of the population combined. Wealth isn't just concentrating, it's spiraling upwards at an ever-increasing breakneck pace. We passed stupid amounts of inequality a long time ago, and we are now approaching dangerous amounts. Societies do not remain stable when inequality gets this out of hand. So here's the question everyone is asking. Should billionaires even exist? That's the question we're going to answer here today, and many of you are going to find my answer shocking. But before we get to that, I want to know what you guys think. So take a second, leave a comment, let me know if you think billionaires should exist or not. All right, let me paint a picture for you. Today, the wealth gap has become a canyon. Social mobility has collapsed, and the American dream is rapidly becoming a myth. And people are understandably mad. The real question, though, is, are billionaires proof that capitalism has finally broken, or are they merely a symptom of a deeper rot in our economic and cultural foundation? Or could it be something else entirely? Have you ever heard of amyloid plaque? For a long time, it was suspected to be the cause of Alzheimer's disease. Whenever you autopsied the brain of someone with Alzheimer's, you would inevitably find amyloid plaque everywhere. Over time, however, researchers began to wonder if instead of being the cause, if it was more like an ambulance at the scene of an accident. Think about it. If you were an alien looking down on Earth and you saw ambulances every time you came across the scene of an accident, you'd be tempted to conclude that ambulances cause accidents. But in reality, they simply show up in response to an injury. If that's billionaires, though, the question is, what's the injury? Part one, the Statue of Liberty and what America used to be. The year is 1886. The Statue of Liberty has just been erected in New York Harbor. Millions of immigrants from all over the world are greeted by the comforting words engraved on Lady Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. However, when those huddled masses set foot on dry land, inequality is going to slap those tired, poor, and huddled masses right in the face. Forget the poem. This is the Gilded Age. By 1897, the richest 4,000 American families, less than 0.03% of the population, had as much wealth as the other 11.6 million families combined. One family alone, the Vanderbilts, controlled more wealth than the entire US Treasury at the time. Sound familiar? Names like Rockefeller, Carnegie, Vanderbilt, and Morgan monopolized industries like oil, steel, and railroads. They built their fortunes through sheer industrial power and complete control of physical assets. They owned the factories, the rails, the mines, and the land. Most importantly, their wealth allowed them to influence politics. By monopolizing industries and wielding regulatory capture as a weapon, however, they gutted the middle class, and that accident sealed their fate. There simply is no social stability in a free society without a thriving middle class. Elites in the Gilded Age seem blind to this, as elites today also seem blind to this. Once you kill the middle class, resentment kicks in, rich people start turning to philanthropy to keep from getting murdered, and I mean that literally, and the masses begin to turn on the whole game of capitalism. Now, that wouldn't be a big deal except for the fact that capitalism is the only economic structure that is actually compatible with freedom. A barter economy doesn't scale, command economies like socialism lead to murder, so does communism. Mixed economies like social democracy are just bus stops on the way to socialism. It only works in small, homogeneous countries, and it kills innovation. And don't take my word for it, just look at the fact that America represents only 4% of the world's population, but accounts for nearly half of all billion-dollar companies in the world. So why did capitalism lead to the grotesque inequality of the Gilded Age? And why is it happening again today? First, because inequality is the historical norm, not the exception. Second, humans are not blank slates. If you believe we are, you're gonna have to explain why 89 of the top 100 marathon runners in the world are all ectomorphic men from a single region in East Africa. For whatever reason, God, evolution, whatever you believe in, has clearly seen fit to give us all different abilities. We are not all created equal physically, psychologically, or intellectually. We do not even get equal developmental or cultural advantages. And as such, you shouldn't expect equality of outcome unless you're willing to set everyone's results to zero through force. And if that sounds tempting, just know that experiment has been run many times in history, and over, history has shown if you force everyone to be equal, it delivers catastrophic results. From Mao's China, where forced equality starved 45 million people to death, to the brutality of both Lenin and Stalin's Soviet utopias, where state-mandated equality resulted in poverty, suffering, and death on a mass scale. History gives us a very clear lesson. If you do nothing to regulate capitalism, you end up with a pathological result that looks exactly like America's Gilded Age. Robber barons abound and they control almost all of wealth and industry. If you swing too far the other way, however, and overregulate capitalism or abolish it altogether, you end up starving people to death, locking them in gulags, or both. But is there a third way? Could you create a monetary system that smooths out capitalism's rough edges through a careful blend of debt, money printing, and entitlements? It's called modern monetary theory, and it turns out that experiment is being run right now, and the results are going to shock you. Welcome to part two, the modern method for printing billionaires. During the COVID-19 pandemic, as millions of Americans lost their jobs and thousands of businesses closed forever, billionaires increased their wealth by over $5 trillion. That's more than the entire GDP of Germany, the world's fourth largest economy. Drink that in. In one of the greatest crises in modern history, billionaires didn't just make it through, they gained more wealth than the entire economic output of Europe's most powerful nation. And that certainly didn't go unnoticed. Many people screamed for reform, calling this result the disgusting outcome of a sinister system called capitalism. But that sucking sound of wealth being hoovered up from the middle class and working poor, going to the billionaire class, is not the result of capitalism. It's the result of financial engineering, and I'm going to prove it. Remember, unequal outcomes are inevitable, but not like this. The modern economy is truly rigged against you. It's just that people don't understand exactly how it's rigged, and the how matters a lot if we're gonna fix it. There are physics to how billionaires are created today, and it's not the same as how they were created in the Gilded Age. In the late 1800s, America faced inequality almost unimaginable, even by today's standards. It was a time dominated by titans like John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil, Andrew Carnegie and U.S. Steel, Cornelius Vanderbilt and the railroads. These massive industrial monopolies concentrated enormous power and wealth by directly owning and controlling the physical assets that made society run. Oil wells, steel mills, railroads, coal mines, you name it. They had a monopoly on it. Workers had almost no protections. Exploitation was the norm. Imagine working 16 hours a day in sweltering factories or dangerous mines, knowing you could lose your job or even your life at any moment with no social safety net whatsoever. Wealth creation wasn't yet accessible to the average person through financial markets like they are today. It was made by direct control over the engines of industry. It was nearly impossible to grab a hold of that ring. Today, however, everything is financialized. This is a literal miracle, as now you don't have to found a company to own a company, or at least a piece of one in the form of a share purchased on the public market. However, in 1913, with the sinister Federal Reserve Act, politicians and the financial elite set us all up to be robbed blind in broad daylight via money printing. This is lovingly known as inflation, but it's a hidden tax that steals from everyone, but only gives back to asset holders. The most grotesque version of this is bank bailouts, where the banks are allowed to use taxpayer dollars to pay huge bonuses for making terrible decisions. That's the real system we have. A central bank was created, allowed to print money out of thin air, charge people interest on that money, And then if the banks give it to the wrong people and lose money, like in 2008, they can just print more money, which is the same as stealing, make the taxpayers cover the losses, and still give themselves gigantic bonuses. I can't believe that's true, but it is. It's absolute madness. And while this will seem insane until I explain it, that is the mechanism by which the modern economy prints billionaires. We now live in an era of central banking, modern monetary theory, and a hyper-financialized economy. That means money isn't real. It's not backed by anything like gold. A banking cartel, literally a cartel, controls the ability to print money out of thin air, and they get paid interest on the money they create. And a well-regulated stock market and fractional shares makes investing in companies a very attractive asset class. And here's the key. Printing money devalues money. Once you understand that, you're gonna understand that there's a difference between wealth and money. Money, the thing you can actually count and spend, loses its purchasing power, and purchasing power is what wealth actually is. When more money is printed, your purchasing power goes down. If you have a system where money printing is allowed and money printing devalues money, then smart people will store their wealth in something that can't be devalued by money printing. These are known as assets. And in a hyper-financialized economy where you can own a piece of a company, if you buy into assets, you're setting yourself up well. If you don't, you're in trouble. So when money is printed, asset prices appear to go up. They don't really. It's just that the value of the dollar is going down. People buy assets as a way to protect themselves from the printing of money. Assets are how you quote unquote beat inflation. Inflation is what causes that sucking sound of money going from the poor and middle class to the wealthy. Inflation. Inflation is your problem. You have a hyper-financialized economy where everybody that understands assets will go and buy assets as a way to escape money printing. But when you print money, you take from everybody, but only asset holders are protected from that inflation. So it looks like their value is going up, up, up. Now, none of that is to deny the incredible innovation that comes out of the entrepreneurial class that generates a ton of wealth. Someone has to create something of value for there to be shares to buy. But without inflation, the dollar value of assets, company shares, houses, art, crypto, etc., just wouldn't go up at the insane rates that we're seeing now. And more importantly, without money printing, and thus without inflation, you wouldn't be able to secretly tax the poor and working class to death. You wouldn't evaporate the middle class. Every time the government gives people something for free via deficit spending, which we do to the tune of $2 trillion a year as of right now, that money is taken from everyone via inflation. But anyone who stores their wealth in assets avoids the brunt of this hidden tax. But almost 50% of Americans don't own assets. Therefore, whether one owns an intelligent basket of assets or not becomes the deciding factor as to whether people in the middle will be pushed up into the upper class or down into the lower class. Asset ownership is effectively the whole game. And when you have an entrepreneur who built a very successful company, they now own the ultimate asset. Barring poor performance, the value of that company will rise as more money is printed, in addition to whatever innovations they create. Every time a bank fails or a housing bubble bursts or a pandemic hits and the Federal Reserve prints more money, on paper, the value of companies go up. They don't go up evenly or all at once, but they go up. It's not that the companies have necessarily become intrinsically more valuable. It's just that people who understand how the economy works are making sure that they spend their money on assets instead of leaving their money vulnerable to the hidden tax of inflation as it would be if they were just saving it in a bank account. Consider this. We are living in a populist moment. Inequality makes people mad, and mad people vote emotionally for whoever is going to let them get a bigger piece of the pie. People want more things for free. Could be a tax cut, could be an entitlement. Either way, if the budget isn't balanced, it means more deficit spending. And more deficit spending means wealth concentrates more at the top due to inflation. And that's how the flywheel of billionaire creation begins spinning out of control. It's not that billionaires are doing something evil, it's that inflation drives up the apparent value of assets. Billionaires are simply the people that own the most of the most valuable assets. The middle class today isn't being killed by billionaires. The middle class is being killed by inflation. Remember, some of the middle class is going to go up into the upper class. but some of the middle class is going to go down. And it's the death of the people in the middle that creates the problem. Democrats and Republicans both have their finger all over policies that perpetuate and intensify this cycle. None of them are helping us out. The addiction to debt and money printing is completely bipartisan, leaving everyday Americans trapped and increasingly desperate and increasingly emotional, which is exactly what populism is. This causes them to vote for free stuff, and the cycle of unsustainable wealth inequality repeats once again. And that brings us to part three, America's shocking decline in social mobility. In the early days of what would become America, roughly 30% of the people who boarded a boat to test their luck in America would be dead before they reached America's shore. Imagine the circumstances a person would have to be in to board a flight if they knew 30% of the passengers would die before reaching their destination. Imagine the personality type that that would attract. And that is exactly how America became the land of liberty and opportunity. In the 1600s, the world was full of oppressive governments and famines. And those poor, tired, huddled masses that yearned to breathe free, they knew they only had one option, America. The Statue of Liberty didn't come first. The American spirit did. The Statue of Liberty was merely trying to express what had already become the American ethos. America didn't have a social safety net. Social Security wouldn't come until 1935. Medicare and Medicaid didn't appear until 1965. Welfare programs and various forms of government assistance emerged mainly during and after the New Deal of the 1930s. In 1886, when the Statue of Liberty went up, federal government spending was primarily focused on just a few key areas: defense, infrastructure projects like railroads, paying interest on the national debt, and basic administrative functions. There were no safety nets, no guarantees of food, shelter, or healthcare, and yet millions came anyway. What they came for was what America uniquely promised: equality of opportunity. Unlike Europe's rigid social classes, America represented a place where social mobility wasn't just theoretical, it was achievable through relentless hard work, determination, and persistence. It wasn't easy, certainly wasn't guaranteed, but the possibility was very real. America represented meritocracy in a way that was unimaginable anywhere else. America stood as a beacon of individual rights and freedoms: freedom of speech, religion, press, and assembly. These were all very rare and extraordinary at the time. People fleeing authoritarian regimes saw America as a radical, hopeful experiment in human liberty, a place worth risking everything for. There was no floor. There was also no ceiling. There was no oppressive government and no aristocracy to gatekeep you. Anyone could make it in America. That was the appeal. Very few people took the risk, but the ones who did turned America into the world's capital of social mobility. At a time when the vast majority of the world was still forced to live under kings and queens, America offered meritocracy instead. Today, however, that's no longer the case. We've gone from the most socially mobile country to 27th place. We now rank behind countries like Denmark, Singapore, and Canada. How did this happen? We traded freedom for security. On the surface, the trade seems like a good idea to many, but as Thomas Sowell has tried desperately to get people to see, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. And the trade-off that security demands is a social safety net. And a social safety net demands bigger government. And a bigger government means debt and money printing. Everyone wants something for free, and nothing comes for free. As Milton Friedman famously noted, the tax rate is whatever the government spends. If the government doesn't tax you directly, it is taxing you secretly via inflation. And as we discussed earlier, the hidden tax of inflation is precisely what accelerates the creation of billionaires and the accumulation of wealth at the top. The great irony of a robust social safety net is that it's the exact thing that kills social mobility. You trade the ups and downs of personal success for a system that makes it increasingly difficult to get out of poverty once you find yourself there. Debt-driven deficit spending policies have created structural barriers so daunting that younger generations are literally drowning under impossible financial burdens. Their path upward effectively blocked. America's monetary policy, specifically endless money printing, has drastically inflated asset prices, saddled people with debt, and made homes nearly impossible to afford. It's also created a bank bailout system that has made education and even healthcare insanely bureaucratic, debt-laden, and astronomically expensive. Think about this. If you're under 40 today, the mountain of debt you're expected to climb out from under is unprecedented. Student debt alone now exceeds $1.7 trillion, shackling graduates before they've even started their careers. Combined with a stark rise in housing prices, which have ballooned completely out of control due to inflation. And the result you get is a generation increasingly trapped economically. They can't break free. And that leads, understandably, to frustrated people who call for more free stuff. Government student loan forgiveness instead of disciplined lending, and rent freezes instead of an actually free market, which, by the way, drives up housing prices. If you want people to be able to get themselves out of poverty and climb up, you have to let people also be at risk of moving down. But this late in the inequality cycle, when people look around and see horrifying amounts of inequality, people are simply not going to let that happen. One of the great ironies of life is that the key to getting more done is to do less, and the key to social mobility and a strong middle class is to allow some people to go broke. The decline in social mobility isn't just financial either. It is deeply psychological and cultural. When people no longer believe upward mobility is even possible, optimism and ambition die. The core values that once defined America, liberty, private property, hard work, resilience, meritocracy, and risk-taking start to crumble, replaced instead by despair, envy, and resignation. Over a century after the Statue of Liberty was erected, America's powerful culture of ambition, meritocracy, and competition is slipping away. Rather than being a place people come to test their mettle, more and more people come today, drawn by promises of guaranteed welfare, government safety nets, and social entitlements. The cultural DNA that once made America uniquely vibrant, competitive, and resilient has morphed into debt accumulation, bailouts, deficit spending, and money printing. And that prints billionaires. That is the thing that gives rise to. We'll get right back to the show, but first, I want to share something that's completely changing how people think about sleep quality. For millions of Americans, staying asleep is harder than falling asleep. I'm one of those people. Like many of you, I've found that listening to audiobooks helps me sleep through the night. It was a game changer. But if you're a side sleeper, traditional earbuds dig painfully into your ear when you lie on a pillow. That's why Oslo Sleep Buds are such a breakthrough. Unlike regular earbuds that stick out and press painfully against your pillow, Oslo's ultra-soft silicone design sits flush with your ear. And with 10 hours of battery life, you can stream podcasts, music, and TV shows, or use their science-backed sleep sounds to block out noise all night long. Get the best sleep of your life with Oslo. Scan the QR code on the screen or click the link in the description or use code IMPACT to get $10 off your pair of Oslo sleep buds. Again, that's code IMPACT for $10 off. And now let's get back to the show. Part 4, the danger of short-term, top-down solutions. In 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down, the world got to witness a shocking natural experiment. What happens when you divide one of the world's most productive cities and run one side with a top-down command economy and the other side with a bottom-up capitalist economy? The answer? The economies were starkly different across multiple dimensions. Remember, this is a city divided in half. In East Germany, the communist side, GDP per capita was only about 30% of West Germany's. Not 30% lower, 30% of the total. The capitalist West Germans produced roughly 3 times more economic output per person than their East German neighbors. Average wages in East Germany were approximately 1/3 of what workers earned in West Germany. This means that for the same work, East Germans only earned 30% of what the capitalists across the street literally earned, equating to significantly lower standard of living. East Germans had a life expectancy approximately 2 to 3 years shorter than their West German counterparts. Communism literally shortened their lives. West Berliners enjoyed modern infrastructure, reliable public transportation, and high-quality housing. In contrast, East Berlin struggled with outdated infrastructure, crumbling buildings, and chronic housing shortages. Over 25% of buildings in East Germany were considered severely deteriorated by the late 1980s. East Germany filed fewer than 1,000 patents annually, compared to over 70,000 patents per year filed by West Germany. The difference in innovation was staggering, nearly 70 times more innovation in the capitalist side of the city. Remember, these are people that are sharing streets. In East Germany, basic consumer goods typically cost a far greater share of workers' monthly salary than in West Germany. For example, a color TV might cost roughly 5 times an average East German's monthly salary compared to less than 1 month's salary in West Germany. Plus, everyday things like cars were extreme luxuries in East Germany. East Germans had to wait an average of 12 to 15 years to get even a small car. Same city, same culture, same language, same genetics. In many cases, we're talking about families that were divided, half on one side, half on the other. And despite all of that similarity, just by changing the economic setup from top down to capitalism, radically different economics and lifestyle outcomes were achieved. When inequality spikes, it is understandable why people start asking things like, should billionaires exist? But top-down economic control doesn't just fail to rectify it and deliver prosperity, it systematically destroys the economy. And even more importantly, it doesn't just destroy the economy, it destroys innovation and the human spirit itself. People living in the East didn't just lack money, they lacked optimism, hope, and confidence in their future. And that's not peculiar to the East German variety of top-down control. That's the nature of top-down control itself. And yet today, when faced with extreme wealth inequality, they still gravitate towards trying to fix the problems of runaway wealth inequality by going after the symptom, in this case billionaires, rather than the actual cause, ever-escalating debt and money printing. It's understandable to pursue dramatic change when social mobility is declining and debt and insanely high prices make the American dream effectively impossible. But the fundamental problem is that top-down populist solutions might feel good in the short term because they punish the wealthy, but they make our problems worse, not better. Economies, like ecosystems, are complex, adaptive systems that respond to incentives. When you disincentivize innovation by confiscating the rewards of your most successful citizens, economic growth slows, wages go down, prices go up on a purchasing power basis, innovation declines, and everyone suffers. Redistribution, forced wealth seizure, and aggressive top-down control might temporarily reduce symptoms, but the core economic and cultural illness remains untouched. And all you have effectively done is equalize everyone at zero. Given the importance of a thriving middle class, if taxing billionaires out of existence worked, I'd be all for it. But historically, we've seen this scenario play out again and again. When governments attempt aggressive top-down interventions like the Soviet Union, North Korea, or East Germany, economic prosperity disappears, replaced by widespread poverty, cultural stagnation, and a pervasive sense of hopelessness. And the Nordic countries, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden, which are often praised for their social democracies, have their own set of trade-offs. They trade low income disparity for high taxes, lower GDP, curtailed growth, and extensive welfare systems that create immigration problems. In 2023, US GDP per capita was $81,000, significantly higher than Denmark, Sweden, and Finland. Only Norway beat the US, and that's because of massive oil reserves, not because their economic policy delivers strong growth. Further, Sweden's GDP per capita growth slowed noticeably post-1970 when they implemented high tax policies, unlike the US, which has lower taxes and has consistently outperformed them. In 2024, the US alone accounted for 49% of all global venture capital funding, while the entire EU, including the Nordic countries, only accounted for 13%. The scope and scale of America's innovation dwarfs the entire world. And the Nordic countries in isolation are a rounding error. Their markets are small and their high tax environments deter the kind of risk-taking needed to compete on the world stage, especially when your competition is China. Oil and gas make up a full 20% of Norway's GDP. Without oil, Norway's GDP per capita drops below the US. Additionally, the Nordic model's high taxes and generous welfare only work in homogeneous small populations with high trust and face massive challenges when scaling to a large, diverse country like the US. In 2023, Nordic countries had among the highest tax to GDP ratios, Denmark at 46.7%, Sweden at 42.6%, Finland at 41.9%, versus the US at 27.7%. Also in the Nordic countries, aging populations are also beginning to strain the welfare systems. Finland's pension costs have risen at an exponential 3.2% annual compounding growth for nearly a decade. To get specific about immigration, Sweden's immigrant unemployment rate is 15.4% versus just 3.6% for natives. Tensions are mounting. Like everything, it's a trade-off. If you don't regulate capitalism at all, you get the madness of the Gilded Age in America. If you regulate it too much, you get socialism. If you aim for the middle, you stagnate. So how do you do this well? Welcome to part five, the real solution. If you want to delete billionaires, you've got to focus on the structural problems that give rise to them in the first place. Just as you don't cure brain cancer by taking Advil, you don't cure inequality by taxing billionaires back to millionaire status. Advil just masks the root cause of the headache, and taxing just stagnates our economy. Said another way, focusing on billionaires is like blaming a fever instead of the infection causing it. And the infection we face right now goes to the very heart of America's monetary structure, economic incentives, and cultural values. Billionaires emerge naturally, inevitably, from a system that rewards debt-driven speculation, asset price inflation, and entitlement, instead of real productivity, genuine innovation, and disciplined ambition. Debt and money printing. Debt and money printing. That should be the area of focus. The inequality that makes people so angry arises out of debt and money printing. And the gimmies that angry people vote for only makes things worse. And so we begin to spiral. The more we deficit spend, the more inequality there is. The more inequality there is, the more we vote for a bigger piece of the pie. And the more we do that, the more we hollow out the middle class and create the phenomenon of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. It is mechanistic. To pull out of this nosedive, we've got to get out from under the $36 trillion in government debt that is costing us a fortune in interest payments alone. And to do that, we have to execute on what Ray Dalio calls a beautiful deleveraging. If you want to learn all about that, just watch this video right here. We've also got to get rid of the Fed, and we've got to hold politicians accountable to a balanced budget. And perhaps most importantly, we need to reclaim the top spot globally for social mobility. We've got to get housing prices down. We've got to stop handing out absurd government-backed loans for college that can't be discharged in bankruptcy court. And we've got to get back to the promise on the Statue of Liberty. We have to allow people to breathe free in a well-regulated democracy built on capitalism. We need to remember that immigration is about opportunity, not a guaranteed safety net. We should be a beacon to the most ambitious, driven, hardworking, and freedom-loving people on the planet, regardless of race, color, or creed. We need to recruit people that want a shot, not a soft place to land. This country was built by people who stepped onto a crowded, filthy ship, fleeing from tyranny, leaving everything familiar behind, knowing they may never see their family again. They often came with nothing, no promises, no guarantees, no welfare, no healthcare, no money, just the promise of opportunity. That's what made us great. But recently, all we've delivered to our fellow Americans are bailouts and massive inequality. We've made it impossible for the average person to succeed, and that's why they're rioting and breaking things. As the African proverb goes, the child who is not embraced by the village will burn it down to feel its warmth. We alienate people when we bury them in debt and then steal what little money they do have through inflation. They may not know exactly what's happening, but they know some people are becoming mega billionaires while they struggle to pay rent. That is a recipe for revolution. So while billionaires aren't evil men hoarding your money, and we should want to celebrate innovation, success, and excellence wholeheartedly, that's never going to happen with an economic system that is knowingly rigged against the masses. And make no mistake, the system is knowingly rigged against you. But it's rigged by politicians, central bankers, and everyone who votes for politicians who promise free stuff. The billionaires, they're just playing the hand they've been dealt, and we should all do the same. I'm not sure that we can save everyone, but we can certainly save each other. Help yourself, help your friends, and help your family. Let change ripple out from there. All right, if you want to see me explore these kind of ideas live, make sure you join me on my YouTube channel live Wednesday and Friday right here. Until then, my friends, be legendary. Take care. Peace.
If you like this conversation, check out this episode to learn more.
In 1913, Argentina was a global superpower, on par with the United States and England. It was wealthier per capita than Germany, France, and Japan combined. These days, though, it is a